You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
My guest today on HeadX is Deborah Witt-Smith, who is the President and CEO of the US Council on Competitiveness. Now, this is a national leadership organization of CEOs, university presidents, labor leaders, and directors of national laboratories. And Deborah leads national efforts in the US to assess emerging competitiveness challenges, to convene leaders who can envisage and implement solutions and organize action aimed at enhancing US competitiveness. This council educates policymakers, the media, and the public on factors that affect the US's ability to innovate and compete. And the council's policy agenda recommends concrete actions to strengthen US competitiveness and secure America's long-term prosperity. She also now leads the Global Federation of Competitiveness Councils, which is a unique network of leaders, councils, industry organizations, government agencies, corporations, universities, research institutes that span more than 30 countries worldwide. And the GFCC is committed to accelerating competitiveness and improving living standards worldwide. What a great purpose, mission, and objective to have. The GFCC does that by catalyzing the exchange of best practices in innovation and competitiveness strategies, a topic close to my heart, and developing and implementing new concepts, initiatives, and tools to advance value creation, productivity, sustainability, and resilience. And in 2016, the GFCC established, of great relevance to listeners of the HeadX podcast, a university and research leadership forum as a living think tank of ideas to optimize research and education in enterprises. And information about the URLF and how to access it will be made available at the release of this podcast. We'll get around to Deborah soon, because Deborah is herself an internationally renowned leading voice on the global economy, on competitiveness, on innovation, and on technology. And she's called upon to testify before the US Congress and appears regularly on global television news networks, including Bloomberg, BBC, CNBC, CNN, and Fox News. Her opinions are featured in leading newspapers and business publications such as the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Business Week, and Fortune. And now she's appearing on HeadX. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you. Delighted to be here, Martin.
Deborah, that's quite an introduction. That's quite a bio. That's quite an extraordinary set of achievements and a story of where you've reached and what you've achieved. But I can imagine it's all been plain sailing, smooth ride, and there's been no hiccups along the way, and you just did it because you just did it. But I can imagine there might have been a journey with a story behind that. And assuming there is, what has been your journey? What has been your story? And then attaining this prominent position in your own national council for 22 years now, and leading this global federation for the last 14, I assume that there must have been calls on your resilience and determination to really get those extraordinary achievements behind you. Would you like to tell us your story?
Well, I have an unconventional story, and maybe, Martin, it's because of where I am in terms of the age cohort. I'm sort of in that first big generation of American women that were highly educated. We emerged in the mid to late 70s, armed with our education and our degrees and all sorts of ideas and ambitions to move in to the workplace in various dimensions. And so we were really the trailblazers. Many of us were the first to hold the positions that we both started with and that we built over our career. So I think just by virtue of that time and the realities of that era, we were both agile and adaptive and resilient. And, you know, today I know some of my colleagues and dear friends, we kind of look at the younger generation and think about, you know, all the concerns about, you know, microaggressions or this or that. And we think of all the things we had to do to get to where we are today. And so I actually feel very blessed that I had the upbringing I did, the education I did, and took the risks, you know, to move into to what has become a very rewarding, intellectually stimulating and a career of service in many ways. But if I may, I'll just share with you that I came from Akron, Ohio. And in those days, Akron was still the epicenter of the global rubber industry, Goodyear and Firestone and General Tire. You know, the story of Akron is kind of a Back to the Future story, because so much of what's happening today, and you'll hear me, I hope, talk about this, you could take this back to a place like Akron that, why was it the center of the rubber industry? Well, there was an entrepreneur, Charles Goodyear, who, you know, developed the technology to vulcanize rubber, and he had the sense to file a patent. And that was the beginning, you know, of Goodyear, but he had to get capital, he had to have infrastructure, he had to have a skilled workforce, and he had to have customers. So the whole development of the rubber industry was tied very much to that whole Midwest story of Henry Ford and the auto industry, and how we created in the U.S. that innovation ecosystem of Ohio. Toledo made all the glass. You know, Toledo was the epicenter for glass, and that's a whole nother interesting story. So I grew up in that environment. And when I went off to university, I went to a university that was still all women, Vassar College. And that was also on the cusp of change, but it was one of the so-called Seven Sisters. And I remember I had never been to New York City and showed up at Vassar, and there was a woman in my dorm, and she said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Akron, Ohio." And she said, "Oh," like that was the end of the earth. And I said, "Where are you from?" And she said, "Scarsdale, New York." And I said, "Well, where's that?" So I was really low on the totem pole, you know, coming from the Midwest and all of that. But I loved Vassar. I loved that time. And I studied things that have shaped my vision, my career, and everything. And that's anthropology and archaeology.
Wow. Hey, that's
so
not
that's
one. Yeah.
That you didn't expect that.
I didn't.
But you know, I've always had a love since I was a little girl in for some reason. I mean, maybe it's a reincarnation, but the Bronze Age Aegean world, the Mycenaean and Minoan civilization, which of course in the mid to late Bronze Age was the epicenter of tremendous technological change, economic transformation. You know, if I ever did a PhD now on this, I'd write, why is it that women in the Mycenaean and Minoan world were extremely powerful? They were priestess, they were queens, they were authors, et cetera, et cetera. But that was my love. And I studied that and went on and got a master's degree at King's College in Cambridge. But I was in the first group of women at King's. So here I was at Vassar, that was in the process of beginning to accept men, and then showed up, you know, in England when King's College was just the first of the Cambridge colleges to accept women, and studying archaeology there. So I share this, Martin, because looking at ancient civilizations and understanding them through the lens of archaeology, but also through what literature we have, what written history from epigraphy and thing, you are looking at bits and pieces and trying to create an understanding and a story of what it means, but you don't have all the pieces. And so you have to begin to be what I call a synthetic thinker and a systems integrator. And because there is no one answer, and that's really very much true, and I'm getting fast forwarding to competitiveness policy and economic policy. It's not just if you have the best tax policy or the regulatory environment or you're great in science and technology, but it's how all these things get put together in a dynamic system that creates the ultimate value. So my education and love of archaeology, in particular this Aegean Bronze Age, has really been a lodestone that I've carried with me in all of my work professionally and now personally, as I go back and do some of that in my spare time.
Well, I said there was probably a story, but I had no idea that the story would take me from the the early pioneering work in tires and rubber from Ohio to the Bronze Age, and all of the I had a sense that there would be some real great examples of breakthroughs in leadership and overcoming disadvantage along the way, because there so often is, and I'm sure that remains a challenge. But look, you've told us a beautiful story there, Deborah, and brought it to some of the issues of why all of that story is so relevant to contemporary issues of global competitiveness. So help us crystallize that a little bit further then.
I'll just follow up on that question, Martin, because again, I mean, and I've written a little bit on this, and happy to share it at some point. I've actually given a few talks on this. And why is the Bronze Age Aegean world a precursor of a 21st century conceptual economy? And there are a few factors. One, they were leaders in probably developing the first sophisticated logistics supply chains. When you read the Linear B tablets that were deciphered by Michael Ventris, you know, during and right after World War II, they were all about accounts. You know, how many sheep, how many pithoses of oil, wine, and things, but recording where they went all over the world. So they were traders. They managed complex logistics supply chain, and they looked outward. They did not look inward. And the other thing they did that's very relevant to innovation and technological leadership over time and through history is that they created a lot of value from intangible assets. And so it turns out that when you go into late kingdom Egyptian pharaoh tombs, such as Amenhotep II and III, that era, you see these beautiful paintings of who are the Khufu and the Mycenaeans carrying their pottery and things, and they became luxury goods. So here they took, you know, pottery, just, you know, from the earth, and they fabricated it through technology, through artistry, through imagination, into these beautiful pieces that became the luxury goods in Egypt and Levant. So they created wealth and prestige out of intangible things, which, of course, has always happened in innovation. And as I said, they were very inclusive in terms of people coming there from all over that Mediterranean world and empowering women. That's a very important point, because if you look at great civilizations and innovators throughout history, women had very important roles. So another thing, what did they do in terms of weaponry? They became military leaders, and that related to power and economy, because how? They learned how to make stronger bronze. Huh. That gave them their advantage. And so they became the dominant force. They went all the way to the UK, many think, to Cornwall to access tin, and they made stronger bronze. And then they became, you know, really the people we read about in Homer and the Iliad, you know, who came together on the shores and went off to fight the mythical, but I believe the real Trojan War. So lots of things that I look at in that civilization are very true, whether we're looking at the great periods of innovation, whether it's in the Renaissance, the beginning of the Industrial Age, the late 19th, 20th century, and now today, some of these same things, you know, follow through. So you really need, I think, more than ever today to understand and appreciate the continuum of human imagination and creativity, but also the technological innovation that gave advantages to leapfrog into new futures and also to have economic and military strength.
Well, that's a beautiful way of drawing on history to illustrate the challenges of today. And I'm really inspired by that, Deborah. And let me invite you to articulate what you see the major challenges to global competitiveness in today's environment then, and in today's language, inspired by that analysis of history. And also help me understand what the role of research, education, and our universities are in fitting in on those challenges as you understand them.
So I think, you know, you alluded to this when we were first speaking, Martin, productivity. Productivity has always been a metric. Again, you look at the productivity, I'm not going to go too back into the past anymore, maybe just take you a little bit into the Neolithic era and farming. But, you know, the whole productivity that enabled us to concentrate food production, and to have surpluses that led to the creation of great cities. That was a productivity story. You know, the whole self-scouring plow that was invented by John Deary, an immigrant from Hungary that ended up in Illinois and Indiana, created the great company John Deere, the tractor company. The self-scouring plow enabled us to open the West and become, in the United States, the largest, most productive food producer and exporter in the world. Those are productivity stories, but technology and innovation enabled that. So fast forward to where we are today. The U.S. has productivity challenges, not as bad as other parts of the world. But if we do not continue to increase our productivity, we will not maintain and deliver a high standard of living for our citizens and succeed globally. So you look at a country like China, you know, rapid economic growth, you know, at some point becoming the world's largest, they have very low productivity. And we see that, you know, in the standard of living. So productivity is a very, very important metric. And it's one of the reasons why at the U.S. Council on Competitiveness, in the last few years, we've established a new national commission on innovation and competitiveness frontiers to really look at what are some of the, yes, the causes we know, and I can talk about that, but what are going to be the drivers to unleash a new wave of productivity that will propel our economy forward that goes way beyond, you know, the productivity burst that we had in the beginning of the IT revolution and the internet and the digitization of everything. What is the next, you know, set of tools, capabilities? Some now, of course, are all saying it's AI. And we're seeing some of that, you know, in various industrial sectors and that are rapidly adopting AI systems. So productivity is very, very important. It's a challenge everywhere in the world. The other, and this is because of our, 24/7 communication, real-time awareness around the world, is really the imperative to have educated people that are also lifelong learners, because everything is becoming so obsolete so quickly. It's not that you're just going to learn this body of knowledge, whether it's in a technical school or a community college or a great university, but you have to be continually building on that, adding it. And this is what some of the great, you know, leaders, you mentioned Michael Crow and others, are doing in their university. They're creating a new cadre of learners and explorers and that are going to be equipped to go out in the world and be able to respond to whatever happens. That's the agility and the resilience. So having a workforce and an educated workforce that can adapt and thrive is important for everyone in the world. And the other component that relates to that is inclusivity versus exclusivity and ensuring, and again, this is where, whether it's online learning, all the digital tools, we now have, and you know this better than I, the capacity for a young person, wherever they're living in the world, if they can be connected, you know, into the internet platforms, they can learn. And that's never happened before, really, in human history. And so that's just a tremendous, exciting, wonderful opportunity for the future. And in a country like the United States, we can no longer justify, in my view, morally, economically, having great swaths of our wonderful country not being fully integrated into our national innovation system. We can't just have Silicon Valley and Chicago and Route 123 and Austin. We need to unleash all of this potential and do so in a way that every American has the opportunity and the pathway to learn and succeed. It doesn't mean that everyone's guaranteed success, you know, we know as human beings, but to have those pathways. So one of the areas that I'm working on so strongly in my role as CEO of the U.S. Council and in the Global Federation, and with a leader like Alex Subas, and I want to give Alex Subas credit for this. I had been referring to a lot of this as place-based innovation, and Alex corrected me, and he said, no, it's place-making innovation. It changes it. It's making the innovation. So those are things everywhere in the world that we need to address. All nations do, you know, different stages and things. And then the other example, two other points I'll make on this, Martin, is nations should not be competing on who has the best tax policy, who has the best, you know, regulatory system. Those are table stakes. You know, you don't want to compete on who could give better tax breaks or things, or, you know, who's going to regulate their economy less or more. You want to compete on ideas, on value creation, delivering things to solve the problems of communities and the great problems of our time, whether they're, you know, ensuring that we can feed everyone in the world with protein-rich diets, how we're going to deal with climate and environment, how we're going to deal with, you know, urbanization and rural connectivity in cities. All of these things, they take creativity, innovation, imagination, and investment in research and development. And so research and development becomes a platform, really, to enable a lot of what I'm talking about. So it's very, very important.
That's absolutely fascinating, Deborah. And look, you talk from your roots in the US and your upbringing and your perspective there. But having led the Global Federation of Competitiveness Councils for so long, you've obviously got a global view. And I'm intrigued by this University and Research Leadership Forum that you've now created within the GFCC, in which you're collaborating with Alex and others around the world. What is that forum? Why was it established, and what's it seeking to achieve?
So thank you for that question. So, you know, in the Global Federation of Competitiveness Council, this really came to be as a partnership between the U.S. Council and our partners in Brazil. In the sort of starting about 2004-05, the U.S. Council, we launched in Brazil a very deep partnership with their competitiveness movement, their Confederation of Industry, and other partners. Why is that? Well, in my view, and I still believe this, the future of the Americas depends on the U.S.-Brazil relationship. We're the two largest nations. We're great food producers. We're wild, crazy democracies. We're artistic. We got people that have come from all over the world, you know, south of Brazil, is German, Italian. So there's a reason these two countries need to collaborate. We came up together with this idea of having this global network. Lots of countries wanted to work with us. Brazil wanted to work with others because they were kind of internally. So we created the GFCC, and the kind of initial mission was every year we were going to meet in a different part of the world. We're going to share best practices on competitiveness. Every year we release a fabulous set of global principles that we all agree to and create on what drives competitiveness and prosperity. But when we met in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in 2016, we were in the western part of King Abdullah Economic City. One of the institutions we visited was KAUST, King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. And the president at the time was a dear friend and colleague, Jean-Luc Chameau, who'd been president of Caltech, and I had known him when he was at Georgia Tech. And so he spoke and everything. And so we were talking a lot about the role of KAUST in transforming Saudi Arabia's research and development, but also social, cultural things, its role anchored in Jeddah and that area. And so we kind of came up with this concept of we need to involve other universities in the GFCC, but through the lens of their role in economic change agents, in the economic transformation, in building the ecosystem for innovation and skills. Not so much how universities are going to change their business model and how they're going to, you know, evolve to online education, but really their anchor in this place-based, place-making innovation. And that was the genesis for creating the University Leadership Forum. We had the first meeting, actually. It was 2015 we were in. In 2016, the then president of Imperial College, Alice Gass, hosted us. We had a great group of leaders that came from universities. Pradeep Khosla, the chancellor of UC San Diego, has been one of the founders and leaders of this. And we launched three important studies that I will still say, Martin, are probably among the best that have ever been done. And they really need more dissemination. One was we looked at exponential innovation and the role of universities around the world and making that happen through case studies. We also looked at the whole area of public-private partnerships. You know, what makes a good public-private partnership with universities and government and industry? How's it designed? How's it structured? How's the intellectual property managed? What are the outcomes? And so this GFCC University Leadership Forum really has been centered around competitiveness outcomes, competitiveness drivers. And I have to tell you that when I talked about it at a meeting at the Council on Competitiveness in Washington, a number of our university president members said, we want one in the US. So now we have our own university leadership forum in the United States that we brought back to the TFCC.
Well, I'm glad you're doing that on a national basis, but I'm even more excited about the fact that you're opening that out to collaborative efforts towards improving competitiveness through universities on a global basis. And I wonder, I'm drawn next to invite you to articulate a little bit further. You've referred to lifelong learning, you've referred to place making and the place of research in partnerships locally. What do you believe the challenge is to global universities to deliver on global competitiveness needs? Are they significant players in all of that? You've already suggested that they are, but...
Well, they are. And again, I know more about US universities than, you know, anywhere in the world. I'm an American. I know, you know, some about the UK, having studied at Cambridge and being involved with Queen's University. But the universities, and I want to start with community colleges all the way up through, you know, liberal arts, public, and then, you know, private research universities. They're in a tissue, they're tissue that connects things. And this whole connectivity and building relationships and partnerships, that there's something that universities can do this in a way that's unique. And increasingly, our national laboratories fit into that as well. They have, you know, missions and things, but to accomplish that mission, they need students, they need faculty that leaders that emerge out of university education. So they're part of that as well. So I want to give you an example. And if, you know, you said you were coming to the United States, so maybe I'll lure you for April 25th and 26th. We are launching, this is going to be so exciting, what we're calling Competitiveness Conversation Across America. And already they're subscribed for the next 3 years. So I have work to do no matter what for the next 3 years. And we're asking university president, chancellor, leaders of the U.S. Council on Competitiveness to bring together in their states and regions all the leadership, you know, the governor, the political people, the members of Congress, the chambers of commerce, the workforce boards, the economic development, the industry, to have a conversation. Here's where we are right now in our innovation capability and capacity. Here are the opportunities, and what do we need to do to get to here? And that first conversation will be in Tennessee, in Nashville, hosted by the Chancellor of Vanderbilt, Daniel Dearmeyer, and the Chancellor of UT, University of Tennessee, Knoxville, Don D. Plowman. We have an incredible steering committee of industry leaders, National Lab, the director of Oak Ridge. We're going to look through the lens of mobility as one lens, because Tennessee is becoming the battery corridor of America, among other things, advanced materials. But without those anchor universities and National Lab, they wouldn't have that capacity. That's what's so exciting about universities now. They are engines of economic transformation.
Well, they certainly need to be, and they certainly seek to be. I wonder if I might question you about how well they're doing that, in that there's a big debate globally, isn't there, of an increasing need for a focus on skills in our future workforce rather than qualifications and certification. And I just wonder how important you feel a view of an increasing focus on skills is to meeting our future productivity and competitiveness needs with regard to the role of universities. Is that a real thing for you?
Yes, it is. And you need both. And that's why community colleges are so important. You know, the two-year community colleges that are very much aligned with the needs of the workforce in the areas where they are, but also identifying, you know, working with industry and trade associations, the needs of the future. But one of the things that's very important on the skills issue, and other parts of the world have not done what we did in the U.S. For instance, Brazil has a very sophisticated national vocational training program called SEBRAE. We allowed in the United States to let our vocational education, high school education, completely atrophy. We denigrated it. And, you know, you can go to any gathering in the United States of leaders, whatever, and you say, well, how many of you want to raise your hand and have your child go work in a factory? Nobody raises their hand. And yet today, with advanced manufacturing, these are highly skilled jobs. They pay a lot of money. They require a lot of training. That's not being done in the university system. Some of that's being done by skilled labor unions, like pipe fitters and plumbers. And, you know, they're also part of Australia, by the way, same union, electrical workers. A lot of that training is doing there. But universities have to play, in my view, and in view of many, a much deeper role in that skills continuum. And they're not. And as you mentioned, the credentialing is very, very important. You know, you can, I mean, one of the issues is too, you get the 4-year degree and nobody really evaluates what have you actually learned? What do you know when you get that piece of paper?
Well, even what we call it, it's called a 4-year degree. It's a time-based model of how long you've put up with and endured a process of being graded rather than have you reached the competency standard.
Right.
It needs fundamental re-examining, as Paul LeBlanc and Scott Pulsifer in your fine country have argued in some very innovative universities, haven't they? And they've also done so by challenging, if they're going to contribute as universities to a global external productivity and competitiveness agenda, then I presume this would be the case with other groups that you work with, that you would expect those organizations that are trying to serve the productivity and competitiveness needs of others to be increasing their own productivity and competitiveness in doing so. I'm not sure that the world's universities are increasing their productivity. The data doesn't seem to suggest so. Is that important?
Well, you know better than I that university culture is very, very conservative. I mean, the structure of university goes back, what, before even the University of Bologna. And, you know, the way everything is organized with, you know, individual disciplines and deans and faculty. I mean, it's a very, very conservative structure as well as governance. And they, in spite of their liking to call for change for everybody else, they don't like to change themselves. I mean, how many places could you go? You raise, well, you know, what other profession has lifelong job security besides a university and tenure? They go crazy, most of them, not all, but some. So they're very, very conservative. That's in the culture. And so, as you said, you know, that's increasingly going to have to change. Also, they're all competing for a smaller part of the pie.
No, they certainly are. And there's lots of data to suggest that. And look, let me pick up on your comment about the culture there by going back to something you said a little bit earlier. You told the story of the Bronze Age and tin from Cornwall and John Deere doing things with plows that transformed the farm machinery economy and picture of the global work. Maybe the 2024 equivalent is AI and digital technologies. And yet the culture of universities to embrace AI in its own operations and then to think about how it exposes its students to AI or bans them from using it is a real clash between technological advancement and traditional culture. I wonder if I make those observations, what would you say about the place of breakthrough contemporary technologies in achieving productivity and serving the needs of global competitiveness? And what responsibility do you feel universities have to be at the leading edge of embracing this technology in their own operations and pedagogy and ensuring graduates have skills in the use of it?
Well, I certainly think that in terms of the operations, the actual running of universities, you know, their cost structures, their productivity, and how they do the work that enables them to be a business, because they're many of them are multi billion dollar investments. They are very decentralized. You know, they have multiple IT systems. I mean, we you can joke and say some of the leading research looking at cybersecurity and resiliency at universities is very insecure because the university IT system is totally non-secure, non-resilient. So those are real issues for the leadership of universities, for presidents and chancellors to put as much attention on those things as they do on getting research grants for faculty to perform basic and applied research, you know, in cutting edge fields. And that's something that the university as an enterprise needs to come together and address. And I think money and scarcity of money and increasing lack of support from the public coffers is going to force more and more of that to occur.
I think you're right. And look, this is a fascinating conversation, Deborah, and one that I'd love for us at HEDX and the collaboration that I have with Alex Subich and others around the world to stay connected with what you're doing with GFCC and the URLF. And one way that Alex and I have talked about doing that is in future events that might embrace this concept that he's been so strong in advocating in his work in Australia and in the UK of Industry 4.0 that's emerged as a descriptor of intelligent digital integrated processes and how they can be used to accelerate productivity, competitiveness in the manufacturing industry and sector. But he and I and many others, and I know you and URLF, have also been intrigued to understand better the term and what it might mean of university or education 4.0 and how the parallel principles could allow universities to be more effective contributors to global efforts to improve productivity and competitiveness. Where do you think the ideas, if they are sufficiently mature, behind University 4.0 or Education 4.0 fit in to a future agenda for URLF and GFCC to advance productivity?
Well, you've just articulated, Martin, what will be a major focal area for the work of the GFCC University Leadership Forum going forward. And one of the co-chairs is Alex Subic. And so we're in the process, you know, of really both designing that and how we're going to engage with others around the world. And it's really going to become, I think, an initiative of the willing. Those who believe in this, see the potential, and want to push things into a new domain versus, you know, a group such as the University Leadership Forum going out and telling people, well, you need to do this, you need to do that, as opposed to those who are the change agents are going to make that happen. And they're going to, you know, create new metrics of success and leadership in their institutions, and they will attract the research money and the investment from government, but as well as from private sector contributors. I'll give you an example. I mean, in the United States, and this is really more about not so much the operational productivity of the institution, but what they're doing. There are a couple institutions in the United States that you would not think are in the forefront of developing some of the most advanced quantum platforms for the military. One is Boise State in Idaho. Okay. Another is South Dakota State University. And the president, Marie Jose Griffiths, who comes from the UK, says, we're no longer the little house on the prairie. Uh-huh. We're the cyber house on the prairie. Every undergraduate there gets 4 years of hardcore cyber. So when they come out, they have clearances. They can immediately move in to every government industrial activity that requires cyber capability, cyber resiliency. Because everything we're talking about, if we don't have the secure cyber resiliency, all of that's going to blow up in smoke.
Wow. Well, I don't know about
that. That's very, very exciting.
Yeah, I've stopped watching Little House on the Prairie some while ago, but I'm trying to keep my eye on how cyber houses are changing. And look, we're probably out of time for today, Deborah, but I sense this is a conversation that I'd really like to keep going into the future. You were trying to lure me a bit earlier, and as soon as you mentioned Nashville, Tennessee, you got me over the line, I have to say.
I have one thing I do want to share with you while I have the opportunity. And that's about what I think is a very, very sophisticated 21st century learning environment that others should think about. And I have a personal association with it, but I love what the structure is for learning and creating ethical leaders at the United States Naval Academy and at West Point. So I want to use the example of the Naval Academy, which is very technical. Every midshipman, you know, male, female, all of them, they get 4 years of hardcore engineering. They have to have all that. But then what they put around it is what they call the arts, the humanities, the social sciences, and the third ring is ethical leadership. Hitler was a leader, but he wasn't ethical. Mm. Putin is a leader, but not ethical. And you cannot have ethical leadership emerging in today's world if you don't have young people. Yes, they have to have technical capability and understanding, but they have to know philosophy, not just Western philosophy, but Buddhist. They have to know the great corpus of human knowledge that we have created as human beings over thousands of years. And that does not come if you learn in these isolated stovepipe silos. And so let's not denigrate or forget the power of learning history, literature, philosophy, all of that, and linking it in to the quantum technology, the materials, all the things in the digital world that are shaping our world. And I really wanted to, that was something I really wanted the opportunity to share with you, Martin. So thank you for giving me a few extra moments to do that.
Absolutely, no problem. I could give you loads more time, and I feel as though I want to come back and have another conversation with you on this podcast in the future. But look, I'm really excited to be working with Alex in the UK. I'm really excited to connect the work that I can contribute to his efforts into what you're doing on GFCC and the URLF. And I'm so pleased to have had the chance to help you share the message of the great work that you're doing with global university leaders that I know listen to this podcast. So for sharing your tales from the Bronze Age to the now and to into the future, Deborah Wintz-Smith, thank you so much for being our guest on the HeadX podcast.
Thank you, Martin. I'm honored to be part of your podcast and look forward to working with you and your colleagues in the months and years ahead, and hope to see you in Belfast in November.
You're on. Belfast, Nashville, bring it on.
All right.